want to begin in Job chapter 32 tonight. Tonight we're going to lead up to God's entrance. Now, it's often been said of someone, probably said it a time or two myself here, when we've had someone preaching other than myself, that this particular individual needs no introduction. Well, if there's ever anyone who didn't need an introduction, it's God. But as we begin Job chapter 32 and carry on through Job chapter 37, God's going to get a sixth chapter introduction as he is about to come on the scene. As we've looked at the book of Job, we've seen Job and all of the horrible things that happened to him, and then his three friends, and they have discussed the philosophical side, trying to decide what horrible things Job did to deserve all the horrible things that happened to him. And they, of course, have found him guilty. He, of course, has found himself the martyr, you might say, that he was unjustly persecuted in these cases, that he hasn't done anything, he's innocent. And now, as we are about to begin chapter 32, we come to a standstill. We come to an impasse. Job has declared his righteousness. I haven't done anything wrong. I didn't deserve this. His friends have declared, you're a sinner. You must have done something bad. Even if we don't know what it is, you're guilty. And neither of them are prepared to give an inch. And so here in chapter 32, we have a brand new character. We didn't even know he was here. There's no telling how many other people may have been sitting around listening to this conversation, because we had no indication that this particular person who's about to speak was even there. All it's talked about up to this point is Job and his three friends. And so now we have Elihu come on the scene. And in chapter 32, beginning in verse 2, it says, "Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachil the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself rather than God." So first of all, Elihu is mad at Job, because Job is declaring himself to be in the right, and proclaiming that God is in the wrong to do these things to him. So he's mad at Job for that. Verse 3, it tells us also, back to his wrath being kindled, he's angry against Job's three friends with his wrath kindled, he says, because they had found no answer. So the first, because they hadn't been able to answer him, they hadn't been able to find him guilty of anything, and yet they had condemned Job. So he's upset at everybody, it seems. He's upset at Job for proclaiming his innocence, and by that, leaving the implication, at least, that God is wrong to allow these things to happen to him that are happening to him. And he's angry at the three friends, because they've been talking for quite a long time, and haven't been able to accomplish anything, and yet they still are proclaiming Job guilty, even though they haven't found anything he's guilty of. Now, we might imagine that in a court of law, if this were to be the case, an attorney might be rather upset if someone was proclaimed guilty when there hasn't been any evidence produced against that person. In this country, at least, we would be upset about that. That's the whole point, is that you have to have evidence against them before you can proclaim them guilty. Innocent until proven guilty. That's the way it works. Now, it doesn't work that way everywhere, but that's the way it's supposed to work in our country. So, Elihu is upset that these three have argued with Job, but they haven't yet pointed out anything that he has done wrong. But they've condemned him nonetheless. They've said he's guilty, even though they can't find how he's guilty. And that's not going to fly with Elihu. Verse 4 tells us that Elihu had waited because all of the others were older than he was. And he expected, well, with age comes wisdom. Isn't that the way the saying goes? And so he was waiting. But now, because they haven't been able to answer Job, he begins to speak. He's going to lay it out. and he's going to get on to Job for it. It's interesting, he says in verses 21 and 22, just so we know what kind of man Elihu is, he says, "Let me not, I pray you, accept any man's person, neither let me give flattering titles unto man, for I know not to give flattering titles, and so doing my maker would soon take me away." So even though he was younger and he gave them respect because they were older, he's now to the point, he says, okay, I don't care about any flattering titles, I'm not going to make a big thing of showing you preference now, I'm just going to let loose on you guys. And particularly on Job, and he addresses Job then at the beginning of chapter 33. And he asks Job to hear his word. In verse number 12 of chapter 33 then, Elihu says, "Behold, in this thou art not just. I will answer thee that God is greater than man." Now he says, basically quoted what Job said. He says, okay, you said this and this and this and this. And basically all of these things that God was basically being unfair. That God was oppressing Job in one way or another. And he says, you're not right to say that. And I'll tell you why. God is greater than man. And then in verse 13 he goes on, he says, "Why do you strive against him? For he giveth not account of any of his matters." In other words, Elihu says, Job, and this is the lesson, really, one of the lessons that we have to learn from this book of Job. Job, God's greater than you, and he doesn't have to answer to you or anybody else for what he does. That's Elihu's message to Job. He doesn't have to answer to you. He's greater than you are. And so in these two verses, 12 and 13, he makes it clear that you better not even try to argue against God. You can't win. One thing, we know that Job's three friends were just that, his friends. We know, as a result of what God says later on, and we'll get to that, that we'll see that some of the things that they spoke apparently weren't true. But Elihu, I'm not sure how to take what he says, because he's not included in that group. When God says that your three friends have not spoken of me what is right, he doesn't include Elihu in that. So I'm not sure where Elihu really falls. I don't know if Elihu, what he says is inspired by God. Maybe he was a prophet. I don't know. Something that gives, we'll try to see if we can find some indication of that in the things that he says, but it's hard to know for sure what his role in this is. But we can say, we do know that what he says is right. We can't question God authority to do anything that he does. We can't doubt his wisdom or his right to perform however he wants to perform. It may not always be the way we want it to be. In fact, a lot of times it may not be the way we want it to be. But he could just as easily step on us all and wipe us off the face of the earth. So we need to take heed to that. In chapter 34, Elihu continues to go on. He says here in verse 10, "Therefore hearken unto me, ye men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should commit iniquity. For the work of a man shall he render unto him, and cause every man to find according to his way. Yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert judgment. Who has given him a charge over the earth, or who has disposed the whole world?" He doesn't have to answer to anybody. He is the final judge, and he will do right. Abraham trusted in that. Abraham proclaimed that God would do right. He knew God would do right. And others have had that faith. faith and that trust in God, that he's going to do what's right. Elihu expresses that. God will not do wickedly. He will not pervert judgment. He's going to do what is right. Now, it might be hard for Job to accept that what was happening to him was right, because he knew he hadn't done anything to bring this on, other than, obviously, he wasn't sinless. He had sinned in his life, but he was faithful to God. He hadn't done anything wicked. He hadn't rebelled against God or turned against God. He didn't have some sort of big secret sins that he was keeping. God said so himself at the beginning of the book. So it's very disturbing to Job, I'm sure, to know, and I don't doubt that Job believes this as well, that God wouldn't do wrong. He knew it. Sometimes, though, when we're in the middle of turmoil like Job was, what we know and what we feel have quite a clash together. And Job didn't feel like what was going on was right, even if he knew that God wouldn't do something wrong. So he was struggling with that, I'm sure. But Elihu makes it clear not to try to outthink God, not to try to accuse God of doing something that's not the proper thing to do. Then we come to chapter 35. And we'll look at the beginning in verse number 6. This is an interesting statement. We always think of our sin as being sins against God or sins against Christ. And we talk about the sinning, in particular deliberate sinning, as being something that crucifies Christ again, that puts him, sends him back to that cross. And we say things like that sometimes. But in actuality, I think what Elihu says here is true. He says in verse 6, if thou sinnest, what doest thou against him? Alright, God, that doesn't mean that it's okay for us to sin. That's not what Elihu's trying to say, but he's trying to say, you know what? Our sins aren't going to hurt God. Now, he doesn't want us to sin. He's displeased when we sin. It may evoke his wrath when we sin. But we're not going to do him any harm. We're not going to damage him somehow by our sin. We're going to damage and destroy ourselves. But we're not going to damage God. We may, by our sins, destroy our influence and lead other people and destroy, in some way, his cause, because people won't trust in him because of what they see in us. Yes, that's true. But he said, what have you done against God? Now, we know when we sin, it is, by definition, sin is doing something against the law of God, against what God has commanded. But we can't hurt him in that way. And so he's right about that. And he says, or if thy transgressions be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? And then he goes on and looks at the other side of it. The other side is the opposite extreme is, if thou be righteous, what givest thou him? What does Jesus say? Even if someone has done, if a servant has done all that's been commanded, if we've done all that's been commanded, we're still a profitable servant. So what if you're righteous? Have you given something to God that's beyond what he had already? It's not a great gift. It's what he, like we talked about this morning, it's what he deserved in the first place. We haven't given him some gift. It's what he deserved. Or, what receiveth he of thine hand? Now see, this is the difference between the true and living God and many of the idols and the false gods. You know, these false gods, the people have to take food to them. And of course, in the Old Testament, they had the sacrifice. They had to bring the grain offerings in them, and they were offering meat offerings and these kind of things. But God made it very clear that it wasn't because he was hungry. It wasn't like they were bringing him food to feed him. No, that food was not going to go to the priest. He told them that in the law, that that's what that was for. But they were supposed to burn certain parts of it on the altar, and he said it would be a sweet-smelling aroma to him. So it wasn't something that he needed. It wasn't that they were providing for his need. It was that they were providing for their own. But he says, if you're righteous, what do you give him? Or what receiveth he with thy hand? What can we give God
that he doesn't already have.
So we talk about when we take a collection and say, you know, we're going to give back to God. Well, we're not really giving it back to God, but we're giving it back to the work of the church, to spread the gospel, to do God's work with. But he survived without all of us. We need to keep these things in proportion. Sometimes we think that we're so important that God just couldn't do without us. We've got to get over that. The Elihu makes that clear to Job. Job, you got all that. It doesn't matter if you disappeared off the earth. God would still be God. He wouldn't be any the less. And if someone was righteous, he wouldn't be any the greater. He's still God, regardless of us. And he says then in verse 8, thy wickedness may hurt a man as thou art, and thy righteousness may profit the son of man. Yes, we do, the things that we do, whether it's good or evil, does affect other people. But it's not going to change God. He's still going to be God, regardless of what we do. Then in chapter 36, we see in verse 2, he says, suffer me a little, and I will show thee that I have yet to speak on God's behalf. He wants to speak on God's behalf. Because that's one of the things that we saw in chapter 31 that Job was saying, was that he wanted God to answer him. Chapter 31 verse 35 that we looked at last week, Job said, oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me. He wants God to answer him. And so Elihu said, well, you know, just let me speak on his behalf here, so that he won't have to come down and talk with you. Then he says in verse 3 and 4, now this is a section that causes me to think the possibilities here that Elijah was indeed inspired as a prophet of God, and that he was truly speaking on behalf of God, as he claims in verse 1. Notice verses, verse 2. Notice what he says in verses 3 and 4. I will fetch my knowledge from afar, and will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly, my word shall not be false. He that is perfect in knowledge is with thee. And then he goes on in other places in this sixth chapter section to tell them that he is going to teach them knowledge. He's going to teach them wisdom. And so it makes you wonder if perhaps God has given him this knowledge. If he does have some sort of miraculous knowledge from God and inspiration. Because he says, he that is perfect in knowledge is with you. And to see why that might be of interest to us, I want us to look, if you might want to mark down as a cross-reference there, to the book of Luke and chapter 1. Now we know Luke was inspired by God to write his gospel. I want us to remember, that Luke was not one of the apostles. So he did not see the things about which he wrote. And yet, notice what Luke says in chapter 1 and verse number 3. It seems good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus, that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed. So Luke takes on the claim himself that he had perfect understanding. Well, how did he have perfect understanding? Well, he had perfect understanding because the Holy Spirit inspired him with perfect understanding. So, either Elihu is a liar, or he's inspired by God. Because he says, here's one with perfect knowledge among you. Here I am, I've got perfect knowledge. Now, none of us would ever, I hope, make that claim. I know I don't have perfect knowledge, and I hope that none of us would ever make that claim. But if he is speaking on God's behalf, if he is inspired by God, then he could make that claim, and it would be true about the events of which he speaks. Now, Luke certainly didn't have perfect understanding of everything in the whole world, from the beginning of the world until the end of the world, and those kinds of things. But he had perfect understanding of what he needed to write his gospel. That's what the Spirit gave him perfect understanding of. And so it's very possible that as Elihu introduces God here, that God has given him perfect knowledge or perfect understanding of the things to say in order to bring this whole argument toward its conclusion, toward the grand finale, if you will. Then we come to chapter 37. And still, Elihu speaks. Elihu's speech is one of the longest of one person speaking that we have anywhere in the Bible. His speech here is longer than the Sermon on the Mount. It's longer than any of the speeches that Job or any of his friends made in the rest of the book. He's got six chapters here that he lets them know what's coming. Notice what he says in chapter 37, beginning in verse number 5. He says, God thundered marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he which we cannot comprehend. For he saith to the snow, be thou on the earth, likewise to the small rain, and to the great rain of his strength. So he begins then, he just tells some of the things that God does. He says in verse 8, did the beasts go into their den and remain in their places? He says, God does all these things. He says, out of the south comes the whirlwind, and the cold out of the north. God's the one that does all this. By the breath of God, frost is given, by the breath, and the breath of the waters is straightened. And he just goes on and on about the things that God does. It's interesting that the first thing he mentions here, that we see God thundereth marvelously with his voice. He's just talking about thunder and lightning in the previous verses there, 2 through 4. He's talking about this particular, I think it's quite probable. Can't say for certain because we weren't there and it doesn't say one way or the other for sure, but I think it's quite probable that the storm is building as Elihu is coming toward his close. As he's coming to the close of his introduction, I think it's quite possible that the cloud, he's speaking of the clouds, he's talking of the thunder, of the lightning. I think it's quite possible that the storm is building, physically building, a storm physical and visible to all of those there. Because in chapter 38, the very first verse says, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. I think it's very possible that there was a storm building on the horizon, and Elihu pointed to it and used it as his illustration here of how God's thunder is heard all across the land. His lightning is seen from the east to the west. The clouds, the water comes, the small rain, the great rain. And he goes on describing how great God is. And then when he's concluded his speech at the end of chapter 37, there's a whirlwind. Now, either that whirlwind just came out of nowhere, or else it came from a storm that had come up. Now, either one of those certainly is a possibility with God. But the fact that Elijah uses all of this imagery of the thunder and the clouds and the rain, I wonder but what, there was a storm coming. But at any rate, he has given God the greatest introduction that anybody's ever given to God, the one who needs no introduction in actuality. But he gave it for six chapters. And now, God's had enough of other people speaking for him. And next week, we're going to see God speak for himself. Now, there comes a time, no matter who you are, when you get tired of other people speaking for you. Because sometimes they get it wrong. And sometimes they claim to know what you wanted them to say and they don't. They're just spouting off things. Sometimes people claim to be speaking for you and they don't even know you. But here, we have, Job and all his friends are trying to take one side. Oh, this is what God says. This is what God thinks. This is what God does. This is the way it is. For 30-some-odd chapters now. And now God is going to speak, and he's going to tell it from his point of view. And it's very impressive. that. We'll look at that next week. You know, if you haven't been introduced to God, there's no better time than now. And perhaps you have known God and have been one of His children, but perhaps you haven't been listening to His voice. It's time to begin to listen. He is the one who can shake the mountains with His thunder, light the sky with His lightning, send the snow and the rain, the seasons of the year. Think about all of the things that He can do that we cannot even fight. I tell you, the weathermen can't even predict when it's going to happen. Even once it starts, they don't know how much is going to happen. Even though it's going on out there, they can't tell you when it's going to stop or how much is going to fall. They can't even predict it, much less try to do it. But God can do it. We need to put our faith and trust in Him and know that what Elijah said of Him was true. He will not pervert judgment. He will not do wicked. We need to put our trust and our faith in Him. If you're here this evening and have a need to respond to the invitation, we ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing.